insurgency transformed American policing. And that does it for today's broadcast. Today would have been Breonna Taylor's 27th birthday. She was shot to death by Louisville police inside her own apartment in Louisville, Kentucky, in March. The officers have not been charged. That does it for our show. To see our whole discussion of the case of Breonna Taylor, go to democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Working with as few people on site as possible. Majority of our amazing team working from home. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Libby Rainey, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Adriana Contreras, Maria Tarasena. I'm Amy Goodman.
Listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from People's Food Co-op, a community-owned, values-driven natural foods cooperative open daily from 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. during the pandemic, featuring farm-direct organic produce from more than 30 local farms, bulk foods, and farmers market every Wednesday year-round. Located at Southeast Tibbet Street and 21st Avenue in Portland for almost 50 years. Online at peoples.coop.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland sees an eighth night of demonstrations downtown. The Portland Urban League and NAACP hosted a Zoom meeting with city and state officials. And in national news, Washington, D.C. has renamed one of its streets in honor of Black Lives Matter. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, June 5th, 2020. I'm Althea Billings. Thousands of protesters demonstrated in Portland on Thursday evening, making it the eighth consecutive day of protests against police brutality and racial injustice following the police-involved death of George Floyd last week. Crowds began gathering at both Southeast and downtown locations around 6 p.m., with members of Albina Christian Life Center setting up a sound system at Pioneer Square, leading the crowd of a few hundred in a warmly greeted prayer. As prayer leaders continued to speak, demonstrators began chanting "Life Up, America," and "Yes, We Can," as the crowd from Southeast Portland made its way downtown to join them. Trailblazer Damian Lillard linked arms with Portland youth, chanting "I Can't Breathe," leading a march from Revolution Hall across the Morrison Bridge to a final destination at Waterfront Park. With the crowd converging at the waterfront, several speakers addressed the demonstrations with words of unity and perseverance, with organizers saying they wanted to hear from a variety of voices and that they planned Thursday's protest to be nonviolent. An organizer addressed the spirited crowd saying, quote, "We do not have justice, so we do not have peace. We can be nonviolent, but we cannot be peaceful." The crowd began cheering upon hearing the news that the city would stop assigning police officers to posts in public schools. At midnight, the crowd that remained sang "Happy Birthday" to Breonna Taylor, a Black EMT killed in Louisville by police in March. Her 27th birthday would have been today. Thursday's protests were peaceful and without incident until about 1:30 a.m. when a small group clashed with police in front of the Justice Center, where objects including glass bottles and fireworks were thrown at officers. Several fires were set, including one that burned the contents of a dumpster. 12 arrests were made. Yesterday afternoon, a Zoom meeting forum took place to hear state and city leaders respond to the Black community's demand for change. KBOO's Ray Bodwell has this report.
In the midst of the ongoing protests, the Urban League and the NAACP of Portland hosted a public forum via Zoom meeting yesterday afternoon. Hosted by President Nkenje Harmon Johnson and Reverend E.D. Mondane, Governor Kate Brown, Mayor Ted Wheeler, and Commissioner Joanne Hardesty participated. Following are just a few of the questions and comments from the 1.5-hour session. We'll start with Governor Brown, Mayor Wheeler, and Commissioner Hardesty's opening statements.
We must do what we can right here in Oregon. This is the state that we love, but it was a state founded on racist ideology, a state constitution that expressly forbid Black residents when it was written. I count myself as one of the many privileged white politicians whose good intentions haven't done enough to tackle the scourge of systemic racism.
I see this as a moment of hopefulness. I see this as a tipping point towards the good, an opportunity for leverage. And it's a moment that we can't allow to pass without making significant changes. It's not on you. This should not rest on the shoulders of the Black community to heal this wound. This is our responsibility, our obligation.
But there was a tipping point, and I believe that tipping point came yesterday. Once that shift happened, I saw real concrete desires by elected leaders to not just talk about doing something, but to actually do something. What our young people have been clear and unambiguous about is that the racially disparate treatment must stop, and it must stop today.
After the introductory remarks, Nkenje Harmon Johnson set clear expectations about what she wanted to hear during the forum.
I am not super interested in hearing about what sounds good. I'm not super interested in just hearing about what folks might want to do and wish we had done. What I want to hear from elected officials and what many of you want to hear is what they're going to do. So among our other objectives tonight is what Commissioner Hardesty, Mayor Wheeler, and Governor Brown intend to do in the next 30, 60, 90 days to make changes that will make a difference in the lives of Black people.
That was followed by statements from the community. Here's protest organizer Darren Golden.
I wanted to share that I am excited and I am happy about what I'm seeing from the community at this point in time. It is, as Nkenje put, it is about time. We have waited too long. We have yelled too much till we are, you know, hoarse in the throat. And it's been going on for generations, and it shouldn't have taken this long, but we have to capitalize on the moment. That means we need leadership from the mayor. That means we need leadership from the governor. That means we need leadership from the commissioners and all of the community leaders. We need to put forward policies that ensure individuals don't die like George Floyd did in the street, that individuals that, you know, just woke up Black don't die just for being Black. We're going to keep protesting. We're going to be in the streets, and we're going to make sure that you hear us until all of the demands are met.
Kimberly Dixon called into the meeting with these comments.
It does begin with stop doing what you've been doing. Governor Brown, Mayor Wheeler, what could that look like? Well, one of the things always comes back to education, fiscal awareness, and pouring resources into where they need to go. I understand that we are in serious economic devastating times, but we cannot pull back resources from where they need to go. You must invest in youth. You must invest in families. You must invest in community.
As the forum was drawing to a close, Nkenje Harmon Johnson once again made her expectations clear in no uncertain terms.
I can't tell you how frustrating it is for most of us to hear folks who have plans now, when we've had plans all along, that are ignored unless we are crying out in the streets. So I appreciate your answers, and do know that it's time, it's past time, and we're not talking about allies anymore. And I will speak for myself in the Urban League when I say we. Allies are so last year. Right now, it's about activists, and I mean activist leaders and activists elected. It's about people who are going to do the thing.
A complete video of yesterday's forum is available on the Urban League of Portland's Facebook page. For KBOO, this is Ray Bodwell.
Earlier today, Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler said he plans to announce new police reforms. He said he has been working with Black city leaders to implement policy changes. In a statement, the mayor announced, quote, "Next week, I plan to share more about a suite of actions that I believe will address police reform and accountability in this city," end quote. He went on to say that it is not his intent to fully defund the police bureau because, quote, "at the end of the day, criminal activity still happens in this community." The announcement came after another night of protests in the city. Wheeler said he's seen many protests during his time as mayor, but this time things feel completely different. He said, quote, "Protesters span all demographics of this community, race, age, gender, and geography. They are coming together to find common ground," end quote. Oregonians are rallying statewide, protesting the brutal death of George Floyd and showing support of the Black Lives Matter movement. Many demonstrations took place with flags at half-mast, following Governor Kate Brown's orders for public institutions to lower their flags from 11 a.m. until sunset Thursday evening, honoring the loss of Floyd. In Ontario, Oregon, hundreds gathered for a Black Lives Matter protest at 6 p.m., marching to City Hall for a vigil for Floyd, with Ontario Mayor Riley Hill and City Councilman Freddy Rodriguez making appearances at the demonstration. Dozens gathered on Thursday evening in the cities of Seaside, Astoria, and Newburgh for protests, with demonstrations in Seaside saying they will be there every day until the policy demands from the movement are met. Protesters could be heard chanting Black Lives Matter and George Floyd's name at a demonstration in St. Helens, where a march ended in front of the Columbia County Courthouse. Eugene drew roughly 300 people at a protest on police brutality, with protesters marching from the federal courthouse to the Whitaker neighborhood, making Thursday's demonstration the seventh consecutive day of protests in the city. Many of these demonstrations observed 8 minutes and 46 seconds of silence in honor of Floyd, who died May 25th after being restrained by a Minneapolis police officer who kneeled on his neck for that length of time. The four officers involved have since been charged with murder. Multnomah County leaders have submitted their application to begin Phase 1 reopening next Friday, June 12th. Under those guidelines, restaurants and bars can reopen under strict guidelines, and public gatherings of up to 25 people are permitted. Multnomah is Oregon's most densely populated county and was the last to apply for reopening. It is also the most diverse county and has a large homeless population. In a release, county officials pointed out that their reapplication framework goes further and is intended to be inclusive. The statement said, quote, "The framework prioritizes the needs of Black, Indigenous, and other communities of color, as well as people over age 65, those living in close quarters, and those with underlying health conditions." State epidemiologists encouraged Governor Kate Brown to start reopening counties between May 15th and June 1st, according to emails obtained by the Portland Tribune. These newly disclosed April emails highlight the tension between political and health concerns in reopening Oregon. Brown had considered letting counties open on May 1st in response to pressure from counties and businesses, although ultimately opted for the earliest date provided by the health authorities, which was May 15th. Health authorities wanted Brown to wait for case numbers to continue on a downward trend and for mitigation efforts like testing and contact tracing to be put in place before reopening the state. Some county officials, like County Chair Jim Bernard, said Brown should have pushed the reopening date to ensure counties had effective contact tracing systems in place. Others have said Brown chose politics over science in reopening counties now facing outbreaks like Marion and Deschutes counties. Oregon Health Authority Director Pat Allen said that Brown's retreat from the earlier opening date, May 1st, showed that she ultimately listened to health authorities, although she opted for the earliest possible reopening date. The contract with the Portland Police Association will expire at the end of this month. KBOO's Ray Bodwell brings us this commentary.
While we're in the midst of the worst global pandemic in 100 years and an overwhelming public display of social activism, negotiations between the City of Portland and one of its municipal employee unions is probably low on the totem pole for many city residents. But it shouldn't be. The union agreement I'm referencing is the one between the city and the Portland Police Association. Discussions between the two sides started several months ago, but the pandemic has postponed those discussions, and at this point it's likely the contract will expire at the end of the month. It's unclear when those negotiations will resume, and until that time, the current contract remains in effect. But with citywide protests against police brutality entering their second week, and long-standing concerns about police tactics, and with about 20% of the city's budget allocated to public safety, which includes police, fire, and emergency services, this delay presents a good opportunity for interested people to make their voices heard. Yesterday, Mayor Wheeler, who is also the city police commissioner, announced that city schools will no longer have police officers, referred to as school resource officers, on site. He also said it was his intention to reallocate $1 million of the PPB budget to a community-led group that ensures Black students and students of color have a better experience in schools. Those are encouraging words. During his comments, Wheeler said, quote, "In the days and weeks to come, I will tell you how Portland will make these changes with the wisdom and advice of our Black leaders. This is also an opportunity to add your voice to the discussion. The next Portland Police Association contract will last for 4 years and represents a significant opportunity for change. Community members who have suggestions or input for the new police contract can contact the mayor with their feedback by email at mayorwheeler@portlandoregon.gov or by phone at 503-823-4120. For KBOO, this is Ray Bodwell.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast at 5:30 for Counterspin. At 6, it's Let's Talk About Race. Then at 7, you'll hear The Struggle with Alyssa Pariah. Tonight, we're going to see cloudy weather and temperatures dropping into the low 50s. Tomorrow, we'll have a rainy and unseasonably cool day with temperatures in the high 50s and possible thunderstorms. On this date in 1851, author and abolitionist Harriet Beecher Stowe published the first installment of Uncle Tom's Cabin. The quote of the day is from Harriet Beecher Stowe, who said, quote, "It's a matter of taking the side of the weak against the strong, something the best people have always done." This morning, Washington, D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser ordered painters to paint the words Black Lives Matter in the street that leads straight to the White House. The bold yellow letters stretch across both lanes of 16th Street Northwest and run for nearly two city blocks. The mayor also renamed that section of street Black Lives Plaza and had the street signs changed to reflect the new name. The street was being repainted at the same time that the mayor was demanding that President Trump remove all extra federal law enforcement and military presence from Washington, D.C. Flanked by D.C. City Council members outside St. John's Church, the mayor told reporters, quote, "We simply all want to be here together to demonstrate that in America you can peacefully assemble, you can bring your grievances to your government, and you can demand change," end quote. Washington is into its second week of protest, with many accusing President Trump of fanning the flames. During a Rose Garden speech on Monday of this week, he promised to dominate the streets. He then brought in military personnel, helicopters, and vehicles to join with the Secret Service to forcibly clear peaceful demonstrations from Lafayette Park across from the White House so that he could walk to St. John's Church for a photo op where he posed with a Bible. Trump had previously only visited the church one time during his tenure as president. In a related story, the American Civil Liberties Union has brought a lawsuit against President Donald Trump and Attorney General William Barr for their use of force to disperse peaceful protests on Monday evening. The ACLU lawsuit was brought on behalf of Black Lives Matter of Washington, D.C., and protesters who were in Lafayette Park on Monday evening. The suit targets the president and attorney general for, quote, the use of violence against peaceful demonstrators who were speaking out against the discriminatory police brutality targeted against Black people. This is one of many lawsuits that are being filed in response to police attacks, including those against journalists covering demonstrations across the country. Democrats and some Republicans have also criticized and questioned the administration's tactics on Monday night. Four House Democratic Committee chairpersons sent a letter to administration officials questioning the legitimacy of the action and stating, quote, "We want to be clear, the use of federal personnel to prevent American citizens from exercising their constitutional right to peaceably assemble represents a direct threat to our democracy." The Metropolitan Urban Indian Directors of Minneapolis, St. Paul Nations, are hosting a fund drive for tribes affected by the local protests. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Native-led community organizations in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area are hosting a donation drive for the Native community after more than a week of unrest in the area due to the death of George Floyd, who was killed in police custody. Many member organizations of the Metropolitan Urban Indian Directors are located around the American Indian Corridor along Franklin Avenue in South Minneapolis. Mary Lagarde is vice chair of the group and is also the executive director of the Minneapolis American Indian Center. She says Native organizations and Native communities were among those hit during protests last week.
Our families that we serve, within, the Minneapolis-St. Paul area, are really suffering because a lot of the stores that, they would normally frequent, they're not there anymore. And then transportation has also been an issue for our community members. And so, we have, responded, each organization is working really to address food security for our community members. And then for some, it's rebuilding.
The Rapid Relief Healing Fund is designed to quickly distribute resources to member organizations to serve the Native community. The Minneapolis American Indian Center is helping distribute food, including to elders. The Navajo Nation is putting a pause on its 57-hour weekend reservation-wide lockdowns as the tribe reevaluates its COVID-19 public health orders. The tribe began the curfews on Easter weekend in an effort to slow the spread of the virus on Navajo land. Nightly curfews will remain in place as well as stay-at-home orders. Data shows a flattening of the curve with a peak which hit in April. In a virtual town hall Wednesday, Navajo Nation President Jonathan Nez urged citizens to continue to take COVID-19 precautions.
Don't let down, though. Just because we give you good news doesn't mean you need to stop doing what we were doing for all these weeks now. Let's continue to do that for our people, because we don't want these spikes to occur and then we're back in the same boat again. Let's work together. Let's honor each other in doing that. Let's honor our people.
As of Wednesday, there were more than 5,600 positive cases of COVID-19 on the Navajo Nation, with more than 2,000 recoveries reported. An art teacher from St. Joseph's Indian School in South Dakota is providing free coloring pages to children as COVID-19 canceled schools and youth activities. China Lockett has more.
The pages feature popular characters from TV and video games with a cultural twist.
And so I wanted to draw something like that the kids would have suggested for me to draw. So I started drawing like pictures of the Mandalorian and Baby Yoda, like doing different like Native stuff like canoeing or Baby Yoda in a cradle board and like Super Mario and Yoshi all like powwow style, and I was just having fun.
She shared these coloring pages virtually and encouraged families to print them off for free and share their finished works. Organizers from several tribes include them in COVID-19 care packages. Budson is also working on several digital animation projects for bilingual books and even a music video. She's noticed an uptick in artist collaboration projects like these since the pandemic, Butson has taken on this extra artwork while finishing out the school year, taking care of her family, and earning her master's in education online. And she recently started getting back into beadwork.
It's like a challenge to myself to make something better than whatever I did last time, so I lose track of time because I just really get into it.
Butson's coloring pages and other work is available through her online shop, My Little Native. I'm Trina Lockett in Rapid City.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Gerrymandering affects how Republicans and Democrats behave. With more on the story, we go to Lily Bulkey with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
Because of gerrymandering, Democrats tend to become more liberal, progressive. Republicans become more conservative, far right. And what happens is, then we're ruling from two extremes, and it's what's causing a lot of the gridlock that we see, particularly in Congress.
Illinois State Senator Melinda Bush on the practice of entrenched interests drawing voting maps created to benefit one party over the other. Yesterday, Republican and Democratic senators in D.C. showed stark differences regarding President Donald Trump's militarized response to mostly peaceful protests in the nation's capital. New maps for elections starting in 2021 are dependent on census data as well as states' compliance with civil rights laws. And now everything is complicated by delays, first because of the Trump administration's attempt to include a citizenship question, and then the pandemic. Even states with elections in 2022 will be under a time crunch. Stephanie Swanson with the Texas League of Women Voters says it's usually a tight turnaround, even in years when the data is timely.
They kind of have an idea, like a ballpark idea, where some of these huge demographic changes are going to be in the state.
In one renowned case, North Carolina Republicans won major victories in the 2010 elections, which allowed them to redraw districts in their favor using that year's census data.
And they ended up creating one of the best gerrymanders in the country.
Professor Steve Green from North Carolina State University says eventually North Carolina's Supreme Court ruled it unconstitutional.
We actually had a court case here where the districts were redrawn because we had a successful state-level challenge to the gerrymandering.
Green hopes whichever party has control after November will move towards an independent commission to draw maps, a growing trend that started with a ballot measure in Arizona. The Virginia legislature has sponsored an initiative there to form their own independent commission, and it will be on the ballot this year. Illinois advocates tried to do the same, but the deadline for ballot initiatives passed while the legislature was out of session due to the new coronavirus. Madeline Dubeck is the executive director of Change Illinois, one of the groups who led the effort.
There could have been 7 Democrats, 7 Republicans, and 3 independents. And they can't be a politician, they can't be a lobbyist, they cannot have worked for an elected official.
Missouri voters overwhelmingly passed Clean Missouri, an amendment in 2018, to have an independent demographer to draw their legislative maps. To repeal that this year, the Republican-controlled legislature has an initiative to return to a commission that Jason Rosenbaum with St. Louis Public Radio says usually resulted in a deadlocked tie.
Basically, what the ballot initiative does is it transfers map-making power from a demographer to a panel of judges.
In Texas, a federal appeals court agreed with the Republican-controlled state leadership that they have the right to decide that fear of COVID-19 is not a valid excuse to vote absentee, though the U.S. Supreme Court might have the final say. Texas is now one of just 6 states still requiring an excuse. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bulkey. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
Staffers at the New York Times have openly disparaged the paper's decision to run Tom Cotton's op-ed calling for troops to quash the protests. With more on the story, we go to KBOO's Nat Moon.
The New York Times on Wednesday published an opinion piece by Republican Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas titled "Send in the Troops," arguing that, quote, rioters have plunged many American cities into anarchy and that the military should be sent as, quote, backup for the police to end the violence. Many Times staff members immediately denounced the op-ed, tweeting the phrase, quote, running this puts Black New York Times staff in danger, with many non-Times journalists echoing the message in solidarity. Many critics of the Times' decision to run the op-ed noted that the paper could have conveyed Cotton's views by reporting on them instead of publishing an opinion piece. Cotton also argued that, quote, cadres of left-wing radicals like Antifa were infiltrating protest marches to exploit Floyd's death for their own anarchic purposes, though the Times itself reported that claims of wide-scale Antifa involvement in the violence is, quote, the biggest piece of protest misinformation. James Bennett, the editor of the Times editorial section, wrote a Twitter thread explaining the paper's decision to run the piece and wrote his own article in the Times defending their decision, though he later admitted he actually hadn't read the piece before they published it. Times staff on Thursday staged a virtual walkout, with some reporters even using a sick day as protest. On Thursday night, the Times issued a statement apologizing for the op-ed, blaming a, quote, rushed editorial process, and vowing to step up its fact-checking process. On Friday, Bennett announced at a meeting that Cotton's op-ed would not be published in print on Sunday as initially planned, and that the Times would add an editor's note to the online version of the piece. Reporting for KABU, I'm Nat Moon.
You are listening to the KABU Evening News for Friday, June 5th, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Jeffrey Wade, Ray Bodwell, Hannah Mersbach, and Nat Moon. The producer is Ray Bodwell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez and Lily Bolke. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KABU programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our listeners. If you would like to support our programming, you can go to kabu.fm, or you can use our mobile app and click on Donate. Stay tuned now for Counterspin.